Chapter 2. Meet the Scrum. How it started, 1 month ago.
Hey, Alex, did you hear the one about the dyslexic sailor?
No.
He spent the night in a warehouse.
Alex threw a beanbag at the joker, John, who caught it out of the air. Their supervisor was unamused.
Pigs, said Mary.
It's okay, Hen, we're committed, said John.
Then she laughed.
You will be.
It was lunchtime in an open-plan office 8 floors above the lobby level of a tower in Canary Wharf. North of Barclays, west of Santander, deep in the beating heart of global commerce. The office was a small clot of strangeness congealed in the pulsing circulation of an investment bank. They were in the bank, but not quite of it, this scrum of half a dozen pigs and chickens. They wore the suits and sometimes talked the talk, but held themselves apart. And when they left at night, they passed through a glassed-in corridor lined with metal detectors before they retrieved their personal phones and wallets and watches from metal lockers beneath the eyes of security guards. Some of them had worked in proprietary trading before joining this group. Others had come straight out of academia, trailing the long shadows of student loans behind them, taken on by the bank as part of their golden handshake. But now they were in the bank, but not of it, for the scrum were not permitted any customer-facing contact at all. Indeed, they were employed by a shell company, the better to enable the parents' corporate management to deny their very existence. There were other signs of distinction about them. Their hours were not governed by the ring of the trading floor bell in Paternoster Square, or any other market, for that matter. Electrons never sleep. Nor did they directly support any of the parent institution's trading teams. They had a designated product owner, it was true, to whom the scrum master, or in their case scrum mistress, was answerable, both for handover of deliverables and negotiation of new goals, and the owner actually worked with a committee of traders and analysts. But the office was carefully structured to keep the members of the scrum as tightly insulated from their parent organisation as possible. That way, deniability could be maintained for as long as possible. I wasn't here, I didn't see this, and I can only offer this fictionalised reconstruction, dredged from the turbid depths of my imagination and seasoned with facts. I got to sit in on the autopsy later, as we uncovered the gruesome history of the scrum. Not that it was particularly awful, up to this point. So, an investment bank has a bunch of in-house proprietary trading teams who specialise in taking positions on the basis of quantitative analysis of which way the markets are trending? There's nothing illegal, immoral, or fattening about that. Investment bank has a group who work on minimising the latency in their trades to reduce the market spread? Ditto. Algorithmic trading teams shoveling out and revoking put offers every few milliseconds to see what falls out of the high-frequency trading tree? We're getting into dubious territory here, but everyone else has been doing it, ever since the Yanks deep-sixed the important bits of the Glass-Steagall Act, and their commercial banks all sprouted high-stakes gambling arms. But that's ancient history. The point is, the bank wasn't doing anything they shouldn't have been doing, at least within the context of the crisis of early 21st century capitalism, until we get to the scrum. A scrum, generic, is, depending on which dictionary you look it up in, either an elaborate way of restarting play in a rugby match, rugby, sort of like American football, only with less body armour and more biting and gouging. I was forced to play it at school. Did wonders for my character. Or one of the quirkier cognitive disorders to which software project management is prone. The rugby version involves getting head down and having a shoving match with the other side, sometimes involving ear-chewing, scrotum-grabbing and neck-breaking, although the latter is frowned upon. The software variant is not dissimilar. It has its origins in agile methodology, although it's agile, hopped up on crystal meth and spoiling for a fight. Exactly the sort of thing you'd expect a bunch of city high-flyers to find appealing, at least in principle, and as long as it didn't look likely to detonate a large landmine under their bonuses. The scrum, singular, was the brainchild of Oscar Menendez, the vast unsympathetic brain at the heart of the bank's data analytics support division, and sometime algorithmic star. Back in the prehistory of the early noughties, they headhunted him from Google to show them how to apply Map Reduce to the very large data sets they were processing in real time. You're not listening, are you? Damn it. I suffered through the briefing. I don't see why you shouldn't have to suffer too. Moving swiftly forward, the bank set up the Scrum to try and bring some of the culture of an agile, highly responsive software startup to bear on the job of developing new and improved tools for high-frequency trading. The Scrum was elite. The Scrum had esprit up to here. The Scrum's long-term planning threshold was about 24 hours, marching to the beat of the daily stand-up meeting. They had a monstrous array of high-power data mining tools, live feeds from every exchange on the planet, their own individual compute server farms. They had a PhD to headcount ratio close to 1-to-1 among the pigs, the hardcore of math quants and algorithm developers. And every day they went in search of new and better techniques for identifying patterns in the data. Trends that might be good for an extra 0.1% margin on every transaction for the handful of seconds it took before their competitors cottoned on. They were brilliant, widely read, incisive, and effortlessly effective analysts and programmers, which is another reason why, ultimately, so many people died. Picture Alex, alone in the office one evening. Picture a 20-something with spectacles and the remnants of a late heavy bombardment of acne, cratering the 80s designer stubble under his jaw. The spectacles are, of course, aggressively black-rimmed and thick-lensed. His suit is expensively tailored, his shirt of finest quality linen, and the collar is just slightly askew, because Alex has an image to defend. That he is a quant, that he is Oscar's intellectual successor, that his mind soars as high above such mundane preoccupations as the city institution's dress code as an SR-71 roaring on Mark III afterburner across the abstract vistas of category theory and algebraic topology. It's actually a total bluff. Like many truly brilliant minds, Alex suffers from an inordinate case of imposter syndrome, with mild hypochondria on top. He routinely arrives in the office each morning as a sweaty, seething blob of fear, certain that at any moment one of his colleagues will expose him as a fraud, unable to prove something as basic as AN equals BN plus CN for any arbitrary integer N. He's convinced that the reason he doesn't have a girlfriend is that he has halitosis. He doesn't. The real reason is that he works over 14 hours a day, 6 days a week, and spends the leftover hours sleeping, eating, and trying not to fall apart. And he used to think that his acne was a symptom of malignant melanoma. Every winter cold is multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis. Right now, he's a bundle of pure anxiety because of his salary. He's theoretically due for a bonus, determined by the overall financial performance of the entire Scrum at the end of the financial year. But his basic salary of a little over £60,000 seems as dwindlingly inadequate as a job seeker's allowance when stacked up against the Cretan excesses on display in the basement car park. And he gets to see the basement car park every morning when he chains up his bicycle after cycling in from his room in a house in Poplar. He's only been in the city for 10 months, although it sometimes feels like a life sentence superimposed on a millisecond, and the habits of impoverished frugality he learned as a student weigh him down, even as he tries to put on a good face for the people he works with. You wouldn't want to be Alex. Being Alex, aged 24 and alone in the city, is awful. But being Alex in 3 hours' time is going to be much, much worse, and he'll still be alive to feel it. One of the great besetting problems of the modern age is what to do with too much information. This is especially true of high-frequency share trading, where every second a Sahara-sized sand dune of data must be gulped down and sifted for the fragrant cat turds of relevant market movements. The ebb and flow of share prices is familiar from 1,000 ticker tape parades and ever-shifting number grids, but that barely scratches the surface of the problem. Your stake in a corporation that makes robot milking machines for the dairy industry can be affected by a press release from an upstream supplier announcing a better image recognition algorithm for udders, or by a newspaper article in which a farmer explains that Because the release cycle for new cows, 9 months and 1 week, is shorter than the release cycle for new udder recognition software, 18 months, they've been breeding cows for teats that are compatible with robot vision systems. Or by a supermarket capping the price of dairy produce, leading to a liquidity crisis in Ambridge. The bank had been addressing the problem of drinking from the data fire hose for many years, of course. Indeed, one of the Scrum's major tasks was to develop the banking equivalent of a self-cleaning litter tray. Tools to help traders visually explore dizzying multidimensional arrays of ever-changing data without oversimplifying it into uselessness or causing them to throw up last night's premier crew. Alex was working late on a surge effort, trying to hook a new data setup to a funky fractal visualizer Dick and Evan had knocked up 2 months earlier. A spanner-based widget that turned 64-dimensional datasets into rolling 3-dimensional landscapes. The gradient and colour and friction and transparency of each crusty outcropping encoding some aspect of the object of fascination. The goal? Pour in the popularity of babies' names over the past decade, sales of movie tickets in matinee showings, the top 40 tracks pirated on BitTorrent, and the phase of the moon. Get out an ordered list of toy manufacturers to buy or sell on the basis of their spin-off movie merchandising prospects. The reality so far? Get out a scary-looking ski slope with black flags on the off-piste runs, not entirely suitable for traversal by a trading desk strapped to a snowboard. Not that Alex knew much about skiing. His early lessons at school had been terminated by an unpleasant fall that had convinced him he'd broken his fibula for 3 days. But after 8 nearly uninterrupted hours of staring at the screen, he'd begun to go squishy-eyed. His bladder was filing for divorce, and the interlocking mass of Mobius gears, squirming behind his eyelids, still resolutely refused to come into sharp focus. "I should go home," he realized. "I'm not getting anywhere. Maybe if I sleep on it, it'll come to me in the night." But what if it didn't? There'd be a reckoning at tomorrow morning's stand-up meeting. In the theatre of his mind's eye, he could see Mary smiling at him pleasantly and voicing all the apologies he'd have loved to keep to himself. He could hear Evan exercising his sense of humour, warped and slightly patronising, playing off the weaknesses of his pair-programming partner. Maybe Oscar gracelessly and grumpily demanding to know what his salary was good for, if not this. "I can't go home," he thought dismally. "Not until I've eaten my dog food." He looked round. For a miracle, he was on his own. Janice was out of the office, dragged down to one of the server farms to supervise installation of some new piece of kit. He vaguely remembered hearing mention of the bank's acquisition of a D-Wave quantum annealer. Dick and Evan had gone along to Rubberneck. Mary and Oscar were in a meeting, and John had left early to attend a summit conference in a pub. It was a rare and peculiar experience to be alone in the Scrum's offices during work hours. "Fuck it," he thought tiredly, then pushed himself back in his chair, seeking the focal point at the exact centre of the cluster of 5 monitors on swivel arms that overhung his desktop. Trading had closed a couple of hours ago. He badly needed a break. "Do I have time for half an hour in EVE Online?" He reached out to touch his mouse and stared into the off-piste depths of My Little Pony affiliate marketing futures just at the moment that one of the stuck Mobius gears in his mind's eye clicked forward a notch. Hiatus. Consciousness crashed back into Alex's head like the shards of a broken stable door banging to the ground behind a fleeing horse. Personality congealed out of nothing, in the midst of a monstrous chittering buzzing like a swarm of bees assembling themselves into larger and more complex units, grabbing hold of each other, reintegrating his scattered thoughts in the aftermath of... what? Alex opened his eyes and tried to make sense of the grainy black-and-white shapes around him. The side of his cheek was hurting. The small of his back ached. He breathed out, inhaled again, and colour flooded into his vision. He was slumped across his desk, and the sharp edges in his face were the keys of his keyboard. He was half out of his chair. "Glad I didn't fall." His arms felt like limp noodles. He tensed, then braced himself and pushed upright. For a moment, the world spun around his head. Then he realized that he was, in fact, moving. His chair was spinning frictionlessly around on the axis of its gas strut. Nausea racked his stomach as he dragged a foot along the anti-static carpet, slowing the gyration. "I must have blacked out," he reasoned. In his head, he watched as Mobius gear trains shimmered and rotated through a five-dimensional planetary cycle, mysterious and ineffable. It made perfect sense, in a manner he couldn't quite bring himself to articulate.
"That's it,"
he realized triumphantly, and grabbed his keyboard to freeze his insight in code before the moment slipped away. 15 minutes passed, or it might have been an hour, or three. Alex saved a new snapshot of the project to the Common Code repository and leaned back, dizzy and still slightly nauseous.
"What's happened?"
he asked aloud, then looked at the screen. Icy panic flooded through his guts.
"I lost consciousness," a corner of his mind gibbered. "I had a mini-stroke, just like Aunt Alicia."
His great-aunt had undergone a series of transient ischemic attacks, then ended up in hospital just in time for the big one. In conjunction with too many gruesome public information ads, her experience had instilled in Alex a deep dread of cerebrovascular accidents. He fully expected to die shuddering on the floor of a dirty toilet cubicle, paralysed on one side. If he so much as drew breath in a room where one of his colleagues had been honking the Honduran high grade. Now, the electric pink elephant of hypochondria sat on his chest, force ventilating him until he felt as if he was about to black out.
"I've got to get to hospital."
He staggered woozily to his feet, clinging to the back of his chair. After a moment, he let it go. It spun lazily around and he wobbled, but kept his balance.
"Hospital," he whimpered.
His employers would view it as a sign of weakness if they knew he needed medical help, but visions of Gru danced through his mind's eye, struck down in his prime by a malignant brain tumour, stroked out at his desk in an epic case of City Karoshi, slain by a Mobius gear train sigil, blurring in and out of three dimensions as it rotated through a fourth and fifth, flame-like fractals, Cantor's dust burning in infinity behind them like malignant fire-rimmed eyes. Through the airlock corridor he stumbled, grabbed his wallet and keys and bicycle helmet from the locker in the hallway outside the Faraday-caged security door. Key swipe, elevator, basement, car park strobed past his shocky vision, still fixed on an interior vista of numinous dread. He threaded his way betwixt Bentley and Range Rover to the bike rack in the corner, tucked next to the fire riser inlets by the garage door leading to the exit ramp.
"Should I be riding if I'm feeling like this? No, but it's faster than waiting for..."
He fastened his helmet strap under his chin with shaking fingers, then clambered astride his steel steed and pedalled unsteadily towards the ramp. Heave and up, heave again and round the bend, a sharp-edged line of daylight advancing across the shadowed concrete towards him. Pain scraped razor edges across his knuckles. A moment later it hit his face. Alex squeezed his eyes shut and gasped at the magnesium flare brilliance flooding over him in place of daylight, forgot to keep his feet on the pedals, and staggered, falling sideways. He landed heavily, rolling. "Car crash, explosion, terrorists," flooded through his mind. Then a moment later he was back in shadow, halfway down the ramp, limp and enervated as a doll with its strings cut. This time, what awakened him from the blackout was the mouth-watering aroma of roast pork flooding his nostrils. The pain was ghastly, sickening. He tried to open his eyes, then to move. Something sharp-edged and hard entangled his legs, the frame of his bike, a Cannondale hybrid that had cost him half his first month's wages. He pushed himself up on his hands and fought back nausea. The backs of his wrists and fingers felt as if they were on fire. His face
must be a bum,
he thought, shocked completely out of rationality. His helmet rim had shielded his eyes from that terrible heat flash, otherwise he'd be blind.
There'll be other survivors. They'll need help.
He grabbed the frame of the bike one-handed and pushed it away, then shoved himself to his feet. He sniffed. The smell was coming from nearby. He tried to lick his lips and nearly bit his tongue with the effort of holding back a scream. Abandoning his bike, he stumbled towards the fire door leading back to the basement elevator lobby. For some reason, it wouldn't open at first. Key card, he realized fuzzily. He put it in his jacket pocket. He tugged at the door handle in increasing frustration, afraid to push his burning hands up against fabric. Push against the wall with one hand, pull with the other. Something gave way, and the door opened. He zoned out in the elevator on the way up to the 8th floor. His next moment of lucidity came in the cool tiled sepulchre of the bathroom. Avoiding the stalls, for some reason they were always terrible, no matter how recently the cleaners had been round, he lurched towards the row of sinks and the wall-wide mirror. His face hurt, a constant pounding burn. Whenever he flexed a muscle, a shivery spike of agony lanced through the skin above it. His hands were less painful. He opened up a cold tap, forced himself to wait until the stream ran cool, then shoved his hands under the water. The bitter stinging began to subside after a few seconds. He peered closely. The backs of both hands were crimson and sore, as if severely sunburned or scalded. Tiny blisters were forming under the skin. He glanced up, risking a look at his face in the mirror. His face. I can't see my face. But he couldn't see the row of toilet stall doors behind him either. There was something in the way, something fuzzy that skittered around the edges of his perception, like a bead of water on a hot stovetop. Drugs? Chemical weapons? The restroom door opened as somebody entered. Wide pinstripes and an even wider wide boy manner. It was one of the commodities team, known to Alex only by sight, swaggering, and by attitude, expansively annoying.
Watch your cock. Spent too long on the sunbed?
Alex spun round, blood in his eye.
Fucking get lost,
he snarled, pain momentarily goading him until he forgot to be afraid.
No, wait, can you see me in the mirror?
The smirking chimp was taken aback.
Hey, no need to get personal. You've been hitting the wacky-backy or something? Of course I can see.
Mobius gears turned in his mind's eye, their teeth meshing at the centre of a beautiful and terrible symbol engraved in his vision, the projection into three-space of an instrument of power that he somehow knew was axisymmetric in seven dimensions. Alex opened his mouth, and the words came with a deep assurance he'd never known before, from somewhere inside him that he hadn't known existed.
I told you to get lost.
Do it!
Chimp Smirker's smile froze. Glassy-eyed, he turned on the heel of one quarter brogue and marched stiff-legged out of the restroom. Alex turned back to the mirror.
I can't believe I just did that,
he told the whirling blind spot where his reflection should be.
Someone must have spiked my...
He looked at his hands again. The redness had faded and the pain was trickling away. And his face... He raised a finger and gingerly touched the tip of his nose. It merely ached.
Psychosomatic, that's it, he mumbled to himself.
Focusing his inner eye on the swirling gear mesh at the heart of the evil mandala.
Fuck! Someone spiked my coffee. Trying to screw me over, make me lose my shit at work, lose my job, too. Who the fuck? Go home and call in sick tomorrow. Work out who's got it in for me later. Fuck.
Was it just his imagination working overtime? Or was he feeling oddly thirsty for something thicker and heavier than water? A tiny, freaked-out voice gibbering in the corner of his mind, the same corner of his mind that nudged him to hide behind the sofa while watching monster movies on TV as a child, prompted him to check his smartphone for that day's sunset time before he moved. And so he waited out the remaining quarter hour until full darkness, shivering in the least filthy toilet stall, telling himself that even though it couldn't possibly be true, where were his fangs? How did he sign up for the opera cape and the widow's peak? It wouldn't do to risk another case of psychosomatic sunburn and mirror blindness. Getting home safely gave Alex more trouble than he might have anticipated, even taking into account his newly acquired stepping on the cracks in the pavement aversion to daylight. When he tried to take the lift down to the parking level, it stopped at the lobby, and he was politely directed elsewhere by uniformed security.
I'm sorry, sir, there's been some sort of attempted forced entry. It's probably just those bloody hippies from Occupy, but we can't take any chances.
But my bike's...
If you want, they can call a car for you at reception, sir. You can collect your bike in the morning. Right now we're in lockdown, just in case one of them made it into the building.
His head spinning, Alex made his way instead to the underground atrium level, and out through the door into the shopping centre. Sunlight didn't filter down this far. You could live like a mole. He stumbled towards the DLR station, hoping he still had enough credit on his Oyster card. The platforms on the DLR were airy, glassed-over tubes, raised well above ground level. As he rode the escalator towards his homebound ride, for a few terrifying seconds he thought he'd made a mistake and that it was still daytime. Everything looked preternaturally bright, the shadows diffuse and lacking in concealment. But it didn't burn, and as he calmed down he realised it was the ochre London overcast, lit from beneath by a million lights. I must be photosensitive, he realised. A migraine. That would explain the visual distortions in the mirror. Of course. And there was mild nausea, too. But he'd occasionally suffered from stress-related migraines before, and this felt different. Alex's current home was a spare bedroom in an old and damp-smelling maisonette, owned by a pleasant middle-aged couple, a nurse and a police support officer. They still thought he was a counter-clerk, because he'd bottled out of telling them precisely what kind of bank he worked for, or in what capacity. It wasn't much of a home. It was more of an ellipsis between student squalor and the penthouse off Mayfair that he planned to take out a subsidised mortgage on the moment his first annual bonus came in. In the meantime, it allowed him to save up frantically in case his bonus didn't come in, and he ended up having to look for another job while picking up his burden of student debt again, the golden handshake not being due to vest fully until he'd put in 2 whole years. He was about to turn the corner onto his street when a knot of deeply intertwined thoughts brought him up sharply. Someone spiked my drinks, led to, I'm hallucinating, which by induction allowed him to derive, I don't want Sam or Valerie to think I'm a user. Knotted around it like a venomous snake was another strange loop of concepts. But if I'm not hallucinating, I really shouldn't be around them, because vampire, right? Alex quite liked his landlords, at least to the extent of not wanting them violently dead. The imminent prospect of sprouting fangs and ripping their throats out was profoundly, mortifyingly embarrassing. Nor could he risk them bursting into his room and opening the curtains to check whether he was sleeping through the afternoon or needed urgent medical help. I need a hotel, he realised. There was a cheap travelodge across the bridge from Poplar Station. Alex headed for it, diverting on the way to pick up a carrier bag of essentials from a late-night supermarket. To his disappointment, the dazed-looking hotel receptionist didn't spare him a second glance. She barely looked at him as she took his credit card, billed him for 2 nights, and droned through the here-is-your-room card spiel. On his way over, he'd obsessively concocted a cover story concerning a lost checked bag, a mugger, and a rainy night in Paris, entirely for nothing as it transpired. Thanks, he mumbled, and made a dash for the lift, trying not to think about the way the arteries in her throat throbbed so seductively. The hotel room was exactly what he'd expected. A minimal salaryman slash family on a budget dormitory, with the basic fittings and no extras. First he hung the Do Not Disturb sign out. Then, for good measure, he reinforced it with an improvised door wedge, a free newspaper he'd grabbed on the way in. The curtains gave him some cause for concern, but he'd thought to buy a roll of duct tape and a pair of scissors. Wobbling and unsteady, he knelt on the dresser to tape around the gaps. They're going to think I'm mad, he thought, and tittered to himself. Locked in a safe space with a bag of munchies and a bathroom, he ought to be okay, as long as he didn't wig out further before sunset tomorrow. Have I lost it already? He wondered. It was barely 10 o'clock. The question of what he was going to do for the next 22 hours was only just beginning to sink in. He lay on the bed fully clothed and stared at the bone-white ceiling until dragons and Mobius gears began to uncoil in the corner of his vision. If I'm not nuts already, I'm going to be nuts by the time I... He snatched up his phone. The face recognition unlock worked, and he could see himself in the phone camera's display. That ought to tell him something if he wasn't so overwrought. He dialed a work contact. As he'd expected, it rang through to voicemail. Good.
Mary? It's Alex. Listen, I'm not well. Actually, spouting at both ends. Really, it's a rotavirus or something. I'll try to make it in tomorrow morning, but if I don't, it's because I'm pebble-dashing the... Uh-oh.
He forced a nauseated gurgle, which came disturbingly easily, and killed the call. Ass covered. Now to sleep, and see if he could see himself in the bathroom mirror in the morning or something. Sleep, of course, didn't come easy, but there were movies on demand. Lots of movies. Movies about lesbian vampire hunters and blood-sucking fiends. Movies with lots of gore and blood. Blood which, on screen, didn't make him feel faint and dizzy, the way the sight of even a trivial graze did in real life. Fascinating. A sleepless but interesting, not to mention amusing and educational night later, Alex prepared to wait out the day in a state of numb boredom. Sleep hadn't come, and time had not restored his ability to see his own reflection. Shaving had been unexpectedly hazardous. In a spirit of masochism, he stuck a pinky through a gap in the duct tape around lunchtime. The resulting blisters took half an hour to subside. By noon, he was reconciled to the horrible truth.
Face it. I don't need sleep. Daylight burns. I can't see myself in the mirror. I yanked the lock right out of the basement door, and I distinctly remember bending my bike frame when I grabbed it.
He raised a finger to his mouth, ran it around the front of his upper jaw.
Is that my imagination, or...
No, it was imagination, at least for now. No fangs, thank God.
Fangs for small mercies, ha ha. There's no such thing as vampires. There's no such thing as vampires. There's no such thing as...
Research. Alex spent much of the day with his smartphone, doing what research he could. Mainly reading the Wikipedia and TV Tropes articles on vampires, but also verifying that the camera could see him. But a left-for-right mirror flip turned his image into a blind-spot distortion. And that he could pluck falling objects out of the air ridiculously fast, on video. Some calculations in Wolfram Alpha confirmed that his reflexes had sped up to such an extent that they were not merely fast, but biomechanically implausible. And while he couldn't see his own image, he could certainly see the hotel toiletries he was juggling. By the time his battery was down to 10%, he knew even less than he had when he started. Except that whatever had happened to him was real, or his pocket computer was in on the conspiracy to gaslight him. Also, despite eating all his munchies and drinking copiously from the bathroom sink, the enervating sensation of thirst wouldn't go away.
What was I doing?
Alex asked the tiles in the bathroom. Introspection revealed a frustrating shortage of black-gowned Elvira wannabes slurping on his carotid artery. Obviously, there was something missing from the common law that it takes a vampire to make a vampire.
I was trying to visualize the phase transition in...
He stopped dead, Mobius gears turning in his mind's eye.
Then I passed out and the weird visuals began. I wonder if it's just me.
A minute later, phone in hand, he waited for the call to connect.
Hi, Evan? Yes, it's me. Sorry I couldn't come in. I was still throwing up everywhere. No, really, you wouldn't thank me. No, I wasn't drinking. Rotavirus, I told Mary. Oh? She said what? The cow. Look, I'm a bit better now, and I'm going to come in this evening, work the late shift to make up for lost hours. The thing is, I was hoping you could stay so I could talk you through my last commit. What? You didn't understand? Look, I'm not surprised. I was already feeling ill, so I didn't dock it very clearly. I'll talk you through it, okay? This evening.
Without ever saying so in so many words, Evan made it clear that he'd had other plans for the evening. No matter. Alex was at his most implausibly persuasive, and kept at it until he could feel Evan's resistance crumbling.
Bastard's probably got a hot date, he thought resentfully.
Evan had a way with the talent that Alex, despite diligent study, had never been able to emulate. something that enabled him to speak to pretty women without derping out like a refugee from the island of Dr. Moreau. Single-sex school, followed by a de facto single-sex faculty and an obsessive-compulsive work ethic, had left Alex with few opportunities to socialise with the opposite sex since the age of 10.
"See you there," Alex insisted. "You are going to stay, aren't you?"
The same sense of assurance filled him.
"You can go after we've gone over that visualization. Bye."
Sunset. Alex left the hotel, not bothering to check out. A taxi to the office and a badge swipe through the turnstile. He took the stairs to the office, intrigued to note that he didn't feel particularly breathless after 16 flights. Passing through the airlock and into the scrum's office, he had to narrow his eyes against the glare of the screens. The office was empty but for Evan, who was waiting for him with a pained expression, as if desperate for the toilet.
"Couldn't you have left this until tomorrow morning?" he demanded. "I had to bail on Candace, and she's going to be..."
"Trust me," Alex leaned over his teammate. "If my hypothesis is correct, it's going to be totally life-changing."
And then there were two.